Right, this is the Cool Shit Podcast. Each week we round up the latest cool shit, helping us think different and keep inspired. What makes it in, what gets left out, and what gets challenged. Is it cool, is it shit?
Or does it cross the magic threshold and come bona fide, certified cool shit?
Welcome to the editor's meeting.
Welcome to the Cool Shit Podcast, episode 59. My name is Gareth Carter, as it usually is. And we have another special because we have another white paper that we've written, an event coming up to discuss some of our findings. We're calling this one The Next Agenda. We've had a little bit of a rebrand, but what we've really done is dive into Next Gen's relationship with luxury and how it can be a confusing territory for brands to navigate, how there are some tropes that come out of it, and then we've got some stories to discuss as well. So we've got people here that are key to the Next Agenda white paper. Firstly, we've got Brett. How you doing, Brett?
Really good, thanks, Gareth.
Good, glad to have you. Matt, who's been working through this from the start. How are you, Matt?
All good.
And James, the little chief, always here.
I was waiting for that.
I thought because it was a special, I might not get that this week.
There was definitely a pregnant pause.
You've been pretty hands-on with the white paper as well.
Very hands-on. Been all over it.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Like a rash.
Okay. I think the first thing to do is work out what our hypotheses was when we stepped into this. And Brett, you're a good person to speak to on that. There were some early conversations, wasn't there, that we were having. And I think it's something that you highlighted straight away as something you thought would be really interesting. Why did you find Next Gen's relationship with luxury an interesting place to investigate?
Spot on. I think there's like two key points there, really. The first one is in a bunch of previous projects, you know, looking into fashion, style, lifestyle, etc. We were hearing a lot of references to luxury from lots of different types of participants, lots of different type of people in the sort of next gen space. And what's really interesting is that there's quite a different expression of luxury, quite a different attitude towards luxury. And in some cases, we were hearing people saying they find luxury in its current state pretty distasteful. So I guess when we were talking about what would be the first sort of theme for the Next Agenda white paper series, as it is now known, we just thought that'd be a great place to start. Because the second point I was going to make is that when you actually look into luxury and you look at the reports that are out there and who's talking about it, who's projecting knowledge of this theme amongst like next gen, Gen Z, you know, there's two key things. One is you get a load of numbers that basically don't really give a lot of nuance and understanding. You get like projections of growth and things like that and how big it's going to be, what it's going to be worth. And then you get a lot of media platforms talking about their audience being the solution for luxury brands to win with the next gen, which of course is quite narrow and not really understanding of the full picture of how luxury works as a sort of dynamic.
Everyone's been doing that for a long time, haven't they? Like next gen, like they're just one monolith of group.
Our bit is the bit you need, you know, like that's the classic, and every media brand is kind of guilty of that. So I think it was just interesting to kick off this project with some desk research, absorb everything that was out there and really sort of just look for the holes and look for the gaps. And I think the bigger picture was really the gap. There wasn't a bigger picture happening that said this is the bigger picture of Gen Z's luxury relationship, and I think that's where this all really kind of started.
A lot of this came down to codes when we were looking at it, different codes that people sort of hold within that. What do we mean when we're talking about codes? I know we're thinking a lot about the socioeconomic relationship with luxury as well, weren't we?
Yeah, the socioeconomic piece is going to be a big part of how we talk about it, because that came out as a really clear, prominent way of distinguishing the different attitudes that we saw and heard. But I think when we talk about the codes, it's kind of to do with the projection of luxury, the application of luxury, like how people are actually using luxury brands in their life on a day-to-day. And that really does like kind of work differently across the different strata from top to bottom. And that's something we really dig into. And we really want to understand that, because we can then help brands to work out how different tiers of the Gen Z audience can unlock meaning, need, usage of luxury, depending on how the product is designed, positioned, how it actually obtains a meaning in their specific space.
So we set out and we did a load of interviews with our Selford network. If you don't know what Selford is, we've got 35,000 next-gen consumers across the globe, and we check in with them to get a cultural understanding of how they see things. And we also spoke to some really cool experts. I had a great conversation with Martin Richard, who has a streetwear brand. He's the founder. For me, that's when it started to make sense. He had a way of describing it, which was the washing machine effect. Do you want to talk about that? Because that was quite cool when he talked about that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It was a brilliant moment in the project. I think we kind of had started to formulate a structure, an idea, feeling for the dynamic of the full picture of Gen Z and their interrelationship and the influence of that interrelationship and how that leads to different applications of luxury. We were talking a lot about the kind of top, middle, bottom, you know, specifically referring to like socioeconomic experience. And when Martin dropped his term, which was the washing machine, and described what that means, I think that was a great moment because it definitely was the perfect name for basically the model that we were kind of like visualizing and starting to see. So I won't want to give away what it means right now because I think that's like a key part of the report. But yeah, definitely look out for the washing machine. It's coming soon.
I think we can give it away. The report will be out by then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, because that was one of the things that was interesting. It's almost counterintuitive because we were talking about this sort of middle stratum, which I think a lot of the people that we know would probably fall into in terms of you're not necessarily kind of luxury obsessed, but you might kind of dip your toe in every now and then. Like that applies to a lot of people. But with this idea that the people at the top and particularly the people at the bottom kind of over index in terms of their influence compared to just the kind of sheer number of them. So it's worth focusing attention on those two poles and not ignoring the people in the middle, but kind of, well, basing it on the idea that because of this washing machine model, they'll all get kind of swept up into it if you can get those two poles.
There was a great moment where Martin said, don't care about the Selfridges shopper, because if you get the other two tiers right within it, they will look after themselves. Matt, did you think that anything was surprising when you've been going through the white paper? Or do you think that because we work with next gen consumers all the time, we're very aware of how they're using luxury. Did anything stick out to you or ring really true to what you thought before we stepped into the research?
Yeah, I mean, staying on that washing machine point, when we started this, Brett kind of pulled out that stat that 40% are luxury rejectors.
I'm not sure I'm having that still.
Well, in one of the first interviews that you did, you know, she kind of was like, yeah, I'm a luxury rejector. And you're like, yeah, but you're wearing like Chanel earrings, justifying things because they were fake and stuff. I think that whole bit in the middle about, are you a luxury rejector? What does that actually mean? And why are you rejecting it? Are you rejecting that for clout? Which is a legitimate reason to reject it, right? Particularly in that age group, people are trying to fit in. And I think that middle band become rejectors to fit in, as much as the upper and lower bands become more accepting and more kind of desiring of luxury brands to fit in as well. So it's not new news that young people want to kind of fit in with their cohort, absolutely. But I just think when you get into that middle bit, this idea of sort of rejection gets quite interesting. And then are there shades within that? Obviously, there's always nuance within these sort of cohorts. We're trying to group people.
I find it really funny when you're speaking to people and they're turned off by the idea of luxury, but then they happily admit that they love thrift luxury.
Yeah.
That's a conflicted statement right there, because you can thrift anything.
That's when shit gets really complex for a brand owner. For me, is I get the bit at the top, and again, we're using broad strokes here for the purposes of this. I get the bit at the top. I understand how I can design products and do storytelling, which is going to appeal to them. I get the bit at the bottom. I understand how I can market, use influence, use celebrity to a certain extent and creativity to get them. How do I get this middle bit? And I think in the past, they might not have bothered. I think now there's this sort of fracturing of the brand landscape. There isn't just the sort of 6 or 7 or 8 big luxury brands anymore. There's the rise of like really elevated streetwear, and all the luxury brands are thinking, shit, we're under threat. We've got to get more of our entire piece of the cake to be buying our brand. And I think whilst we know about this washing machine effect, I don't think the brands leave them alone. I think they try and get absolutely everything and quite often end up not getting any of them, or getting it wrong on within certain cohorts, getting it really, really wrong. I think it takes a very, very sophisticated brand to go, right, we're going to stratify our product, we're going to stratify our marketing, we're going to segment everything so we kind of try and keep all of those people sort of happy. I mean, that's notwithstanding the really interesting bit in the white paper for me is the influence from top and bottom into those middle groups, right? There's a definite influence there, but I do feel like brands sometimes try and do it all and quite often really fuck it up.
I guess they're doing it all, but with the idea of either just focusing on like pinnacle product and like bashing everyone with the idea this is the best product in the world and trying to create that desire, or going kind of to the bottom and creating like a, you know, like you could say that Fear of God or Balenciaga has really gone into the space of like the white logo on the black t-shirt that's like hyper visible so that they can like provide those products that people use to say like, I'm moving up in the world because I can afford this brand now. And then you see a lot of focus on that middle bit, and it tends to be where the streetwear element comes in. You know, it's like affluent streetwear culture, collabs, all this kind of stuff. But I think the key thing to understand is that in the middle, that tension around rejection, to reject or not to reject, is really an ethical one and it's a moral one. And if you can understand what those like hurdles are, then you can really kind of overcome the luxury rejector mindset. You can kind of shrink that a little if you can really nail those kind of hurdles.
Is it then that some of the people who would profess to be luxury rejectors are potentially basing that off of like typical conceptions of luxury as being like elitist, for example? And with those new brands who are coming up, like, you can imagine some of them justifying their participation almost by thinking that some of those brands aren't really luxury. They'd go, oh no, that's just expensive streetwear. But obviously the lines there are slightly blurring between the two.
I think so much of it is about the flex. Yeah, so from a lower socioeconomic background, the flex of wearing luxury shows that you're going places. And I think that rejector in the middle really hates that flex. That kind of makes them cringe a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not even buying that though, because I used to...
I don't buy it.
I used to badmouth all of my friends for wearing like overpriced Machino shirts, but I couldn't afford one. Then when I could afford one, I bought one.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like those three stratas that we've talked about, and what Brett's just hinted that they're overcoming why they're rejecting and stuff. The top strata, I still think like craftsmanship and the best of is like super important. The bottom strata is like, is it cool? Do my icons wear it? Does it kind of signal the success, that the flex, right? Mm. And then the bit in the middle, which I think most of the brands are doing, but it's not quite risen to the top of their story, because effectively you're looking at like this revolving three-pointed fucking triangle, right? That bit in the middle around sustainability, almost all of the luxury brands now have got a lot better on their sustainability. Wasn't that long ago, right, that I think it was Burberry that burnt like 10,000 handbags, and it just sent ripples into the fucking retail markets, and everyone like absolutely slated them. But they're all kind of racing towards net zero, but all of these stories are sort of just buried because they can't lead with it, because they know that that's less important. That's table stakes for your high-end sort of shopper. It's kind of like, yeah, well, whatever, you know, table stakes. Is it the best still? You know, is it sewn by, you know, a nonna in an Italian atelier or something like that? And then at the bottom, it's kind of like, don't care. I just want to look the business. I want to ape my icons, and I want to have the flex, like, in my community. And I feel like they're sort of worried, and
they're confused, right?
They're confused, and they can't just go and lead with that yet, because they've got 300 years of heritage and status that they still need to talk about. And then they've got these kind of relationships with like iconic rappers, footballers, NBA players, all the rest of it that they've got to worry about. It's like, well, confusing if you're a brand manager.
And also for the people who care about that, it's a difficult thing for a brand to flex their ethical values, because for the people who care about it, it should almost be a baseline. That's the starting point almost. What you really don't want to do is fall into the trap of just coming across as bogus virtue signaling bullshit.
Yeah, the equivalent of a Costa rainbow cup or something like that.
Exactly, like, hey, look at the planet, we love this planet. Yeah,
you talked about it, collabs, and you know, like, I thought collabs were done about like 6 years ago, but it seems to be we're still in peak collab. Who is that collab market for? That's what I find really interesting, because you know, you've got hip hop culture, which has embraced luxury, and luxury now tries to work with certain artists, but you know, that happened without their involvement essentially. And I feel like a lot of the time when I'm thinking, like, who's buying the Adidas Gucci tracksuit? Like, who is that for? I think a lot of the ideas around streetwear is a reaction to trying to sew up these markets. But I'm wondering, who is it that spends that £1,700? Who are they trying to speak to, do you think, Brett, when they're producing those collabs?
The way I understand it, it's like tentacles. You've got a core brand that's like understanding there's an opportunity to show up in the world of many more people. That's what this sort of white paper talks about, is the idea of growing the pie, getting more people to know about your brand, so that at some point in the future, their brand is the one you're kind of, you know, looking towards and kind of admiring the most, aspiring to the most. So in terms of collabs, I think it's like tentacles, and you can see it in the kind of stories we might talk about in a minute, where brands are reaching into all different kinds of audiences. And to be honest, let's be really real. These are stories, first and foremost. There's a product involvement, but it's mainly a story that gets a certain media coverage, a certain audience's attention. It either feeds into hype culture, or it can feed into mainstream culture. I just saw like Pretty Little Thing, Naomi Campbell just dropped. I just seen like Boohoo, RD has just dropped. I mean, these are all strategic like collabs to like light up and keep certain audiences engaged, right? And then you've got, like you said, collabs across the board with different kinds of audiences. So I just literally think it's like the central brand, normally the bigger brand, the sort of the fashion brand, just trying to open up a little bit of like headspace in all different kinds of audiences because they know it's a very fragmented, segmented landscape.
Pre-collabs, and I remember like that long ago.
Matt is pre-collab. Did you hear that? He's that old.
And PC. You know, we'd work with brands on their sort of launch calendar, you know, for products and stuff. And you'd put the stories together, working with kind of a global brand that was in multiple categories, multiple sports, for example. You'd look at like what the seasonal story was going to be. You'd look at what the major launches were going to be and what are the energy moments. It used to just be called an energy moment, which is exactly what Brett's just described. It's just those energy moments. Now they've realized you can stack up 12, 18, 2 years of content by having those collabs planned out, you know. And I think a lot of that was driven by the brands like Supreme getting into drops and planning ahead and all of that sort of stuff. And then it took, you know, the bigger brands time to sort of catch up. And could they move quick enough? Because you think like some of this stuff's in the factory from 2 years out, right? So they then all started to panic and go, right, how do we do this? But I think what they've almost accidentally uncovered is if you're a big enough brand, which goes across all of those strata of consumers that we're talking about, you can use those collabs to sort of go, right, well, that's going to appeal to them, that's going to appeal to them, and that's going to appeal to them, if you're careful about how you market it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was almost an accident. I sometimes wonder whether that was strategy and really well thought out, or is like
or just Forrest Gumped their way there.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like some hit, some miss. Most of them hit now because brands are well researched, they understand their audience a bit more and all of that sort of stuff, but still feel like we're missing out on that kind of middle ground a bit.
There was a really nice chart that someone on my feed on LinkedIn dropped it the other day, and it's like a Google Trends, and it's about search for Adidas Samba, and it basically tracks the kind of trajectory of that and then maps the kind of key cultural moments, let's say key cultural moments like celeb visibility, who's wearing it when, etc. And it just shows you the upward trend of like how they basically kind of got that heat. But the thing is, yeah, great, they've unlocked this ability to, as Matt, you just said, to kind of strategize that, to make that playbook like clear a couple of years ahead of when they're dropping the product, etc., so they can build towards that mass various kind of subcultural adoption. But that does never leave a long-term impact. No one ever thinks like 2-3 years later, like, oh, that was a sick moment in style and culture. It doesn't happen. Like, look at the NMD thing. That was like huge. And like, no one talks about that as like an iconic look from that era. No one. Even the Stan Smith moment, like when that happened, like, you know, Adidas has like done this so many times, but never in recent times, in the last 10, 15 years, has that been like a look, a cultural moment that everybody goes, that was the look. It's just always like it floods, and then everyone ditches it because everyone's got it.
You're almost a victim of that cycle. Everyone's forgetting because there's another one that's front of mind, another one that's front of mind a month later and all the rest of it. So like, how do you as a brand shift like what fashion or what style is doing when you're constantly on this fucking treadmill?
James talked to me earlier on about the Nike Tiffany collab, and I was like, oh yeah, shit, remember that? And that's like, what, 3 months ago? Like,
something like that, yeah.
Something like that. Nike have moved on, people have moved on. Like, it's, you know, I thought like the Wales Bonner and the Adidas stuff, that like is starting to do this kind of quite cool 70s sort of vibe. That's Wales Bonner sort of vibe, right? And I thought, well, maybe this is going to stick around for a bit. But then, you know, they'll suddenly tangent over here with something, some other shiny moment, you know.
But also, if it does stick, it can end up kind of becoming a victim of its own success. Because, like, the Samba, for example, went so massive that people say, like, it's like a joke that if you're wearing Sambas, it's a way of showing that you've got no personality or kind of creativity.
Yeah, you've
like,
seen the
Pandas. Which is why I've stopped wearing mine.
Yeah, the Nike Pandas was a thing for, exactly. 6 months or whatever it was, yeah.
We've lent in a little bit there into fashion. It's an interesting thing that when we're speaking to next gen, they do as well. Fashion is their first go-to when they're thinking about luxury. We also spoke to Nick English at Bremont Watches, and although they aren't necessarily chasing that early consumer, so that the Gen Z person that's coming into it, they're still aware of it. And he was talking about doing that through craft, talking to young people about the craft of watchmaking and trying to get them into his company young. And then I think one of the younger guys, when we mentioned watches, he was like, yeah, that's for later. So it's interesting for those brands that don't see themselves as necessarily a Gen Z target, but they still have to be really aware of it, don't they? They still have to regen into a market and keep people coming back for the brand.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about sales. I mean, let's be honest, pinnacle luxury products aren't in the realm of like affordability for most young people, right? Yeah, of course, there's a small portion who can afford like a 10, 15 grand handbag or whatever, but the majority...
James, you can afford a 10, 15 grand handbag. You've got a couple of them,
I've got a wardrobe wardrobe full of them, walk-in wardrobe, yeah.
But yeah, it's like, it's not about sales. It's about priming, it's about top of mind, it's about aspiration, it's about confirming that that is the thing at some point that you would like to add to your life,
yeah.
Because you believe that it's going to continue to project how you want to be seen.
And I think that's a really good point. And then just jumping back to sort of like the more fashion-led stuff, like the £350 pair of Gucci glasses are just a really good way for that next-gen consumer to be in the club, right? To have those products that still are from that luxury stable, but feel affordable to them and still do that job of feeling like a flex, but getting them into the brand early, right?
But that's the thing, the very kind of concept of aspiration is sort of dependent on not being able to have it right now, because it's got to be something that you're kind of chasing in the future. And when you get there, that's almost like an indication of having made it. So like, it would obviously be a mistake for these kind of luxury brands to think they're like Gen Z, next gen, whatever we're saying, aren't their audience, because they might not be now in terms of sales, but they will be. And unless you get them now, then they won't be for sales, sort of thing.
Even that, I think brands have gone wider than they've ever gone before, because those luxury brands of old used to almost like prime you with their brand, but then wait for you to hit that point in your life when A, you've got the money, and B, you've got the appreciation of their craft. Whereas now I think they're also looking like about creativity a lot more, that, you know, we as people have sort of changed and we are more creative as a species, right? Because of all of the technology and tools that we've got. So I don't think luxury brands used to be anywhere near as creative. I'm really glad that they are, because it means that like your sort of style can be a bit more fun now. You can be a bit more expressive with it if you want to, I guess, you know. Whereas there was an expectation that you kind of grow up, you get a bit serious, you get a bit of money, you get into how things are made, not necessarily just how they're expressed. So like, I think like that's sort of post-hipster. You can wear something just because it's out there and creative and still be luxury, I think, driven by streetwear, driven by the self-expression of the celebrities and the people of influence who wear stuff. Is like, we're in a much better place, I think, for luxury now.
All right then, James, what are the stories that you've got this week that we're going to put them through the lens of what we've been talking about?
It's not a normal podcast. They're not normal stories. Some of them are more kind of jumping off points. But this kind of goes on from what we were saying earlier, that when we were looking for like relevant stories that we could talk about, the vast majority of examples were collabs. And like, again, it's because of that point of like luxury brands trying to shortcut their way into like the next gen zeitgeist by turning up in places where that audience is already engaged. And like, one of the main areas where that's been happening for probably about a few years is between like football and high fashion. So you've had like collaborations like AC Milan and Off-White, Real Madrid and Zegna, and like just a few weeks ago there was like a Martine Rose collection for the US women's football team. Then I think she did something like last night with the Lionesses as well. And it's not just fashion, like Bayern Munich have an ongoing relationship with Audi, blah blah blah. At first a lot of these like jarred slightly, particularly with like your kind of your typical football fan who doesn't like anything changing ever and thinks the game's gone, blah blah blah, crying into a pint of John Smith's. But now, like I've seen through being on football socials, they're actually going down pretty well a lot of the time, even with some people who were never going to drive an Audi probably and never going to buy Off-White, but they can still appreciate it. Again, this is just kind of leaping off point. That is interesting to see how like luxury brands have identified this football as an easy way of tapping into a new generation, new market of consumers.
Well, like Matt says, like football has got a lot more creative, hasn't it, over the last sort of 10 years. It's got like hyper creative. I wonder with these collabs, we'll go around the table and talk about this story, but with these collabs, it's not the people that are on the terraces anyway, are they?
No,
it's not for them essentially. But I have an amount of cynicism for the amount of football collabs you get, and some of them I think are really cool, some of them I'm like a little bit meh. I did like the article in Esquire, mainly because it was shit, and Matt, who is a Liverpool fan, called out. It says, 5 designer soccer collabs that deliver style on and off the pitch, fashion you can get behind even if you're a Liverpool fan.
See, like, I don't know whether that's a backhanded compliment or just a straight out
insult. I don't get it.
Well, we've got a history of wearing awful white Armani suits at the FA Cup final. So
Spice
we've got,
Boys, yeah.
Yeah, we've got a dark side to Liverpool's kind of fashion association. But obviously then you've got casuals, terrace wear, European brands, which, you know, I'm going to take credit for that, me personally.
Football and luxury collabs. What's your thoughts on this?
It depends how it's executed. Like, I felt like a lone voice in the dark when I absolutely hammered that awful Messi Ronaldo chess bullshit that came out pre-World Cup, because I just thought it was awful. It was like super, super cringe.
Who was that?
Vuitton. Yeah, it was Vuitton sort of luggage.
It's a very grey photo.
Yeah, and it was like they made a big deal out of the fact that they'd comped in players that weren't there in the same room.
And I think if you've ever worked in football, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, I think Annie Leibovitz shot it and all the rest. I was just like, oh, it just feels so sort of forced and cold. But, you know, one of the world's most famous photographers, it looked like some retoucher had killed it.
Well, is that an example of a typical traditional luxury brand not having to be that creative because they don't think they have to, because it's just star Messi Ronaldo, like it wouldn't take long to come up with that, just getting playing chess.
Well, Matt didn't like it, but I bet it got shared by a lot of people saying goals.
It's the most liked photo ever on the internet, I think.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Like the second or something.
The reach it gets is enormous. The star power speaks for itself, and I think if you're a fan of those players from anywhere in the world, right, you know, it creates debate, because you've got like Messi stands and Ronaldo stands, and straight away you're just going to get fire all over the internet. So it was effective, but it just creatively, it just left me absolutely fucking cold, right?
Yeah, that was going to be my point, is like, let's be honest, who's it really for? Like, who really is influenced by Ronaldo or Messi right now? And when we're talking about priming younger minds to think about brands in the future, that is exactly what Louis Vuitton were doing. I mean, there probably are adults who are like, oh, I follow what those guys wear, how they shop, whatever. But
oh, not with the way Ronaldo.
Messi got slated.
So
yeah, but Messi got slated even last week. Like, he had these like wavy turn-ups on his jeans, and they were like, he's come to Miami, he's been here a couple of weeks, and he's started to dress weirdly and all the rest of it. I just think him and Ronaldo, like, they've never been exactly icons of style. Do you know what I mean?
This is the point that I was going to make. Now, like, with Messi now being in the US, I think we're going to only see even more of these types of collabs, because like all of the various luxury brands in the US, I imagine are seeing an opportunity here with like eyes all of a sudden being on football, soccer. And like, even if you just look at like the amount of celebrities who are all showing up at the games now, I don't know, you'd imagine that they'd be keen to prime or get a load of those wearing their gear, turning up to the games, getting photographed, etc.
It might be my relationship with the game, but I think football will never be as cool as like NBA.
Oh no, it never will be. We're trying hard at the moment. It just can't be.
It might be I don't watch enough NBA, but I still feel like footballers feel like working class lads who've come into a shitload of money, and not all of them. I think it's the game's definitely changing on that, helped by people like Versus and all the rest of it, and proper stylists. But there's still a lot of boys there wearing, and girls wearing, some proper dodgy clobber. Like in the NBA, they've just got a bit more about them.
I don't know, man. I think we see what we want to see. We see the people who dress well. We see the ones who get championed for their sneaker taste. We see the ones who are championed for their designer clothing taste. Don't forget, these guys don't fit into regular clothes. You know what I mean? They're basically getting bespoke made like sizes and stuff like that. So if they're really into it, they probably spend the money and do it well.
Maybe they just got there first, like with the tunnel walks and things like that. Yeah. And like I said, there's some young footballers now, like Tom Davies. He had a very clear sense of who he was and his style and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, they've got rinse for it. But yeah, I always quite like that as well. And same with Calvert-Lewin. Like, I always appreciated it. But like, just from like a football perspective, you're making yourself a target with that, because like,
put Calvert-Lewin in a skirt.
Exactly. As soon as Calvert-Lewin has a bad game, then you get all the various Terrys and Barrys saying it's because he was in that fucking skirt.
Yeah. Could be a lot worse. It could have been Calvin Phillips in his Loewe, whatever they wear, boots. Like, oh my God.
But isn't that the name of the game right now? These guys are trying to build their profile outside the game, get their fashion kudos up, get their social media following up, because that's where they're going to monetize in the future. Just
get professional help then.
But you know, trolling is trolling, and that is actually a strategy in its own right. So I think most of that stuff is orchestrated, like considered.
Yeah, I think if they're standing for something, whether it's their own like self-expression, whether it's a bit more creativity, I'm on board. Like, despite the trolling, you know, I'm on board. It's when it sort of just feels like that vanilla bullshit somewhere in the middle will appeal to everyone, but not really kind of resonate with anyone.
Well, I'm looking at this, like, I've literally got a photo in front of me, this Arsenal Stella McCartney kit, and I think the shirt looks nice. There's a bum bag, it's quite affordable, I guess. Like, or fanny pack, as you like to call them, James.
That's what they're called,
crossbody, I think.
For like 120. Which seems quite affordable for a Stella McCartney piece. But I'm just wondering, who the fuck is that for? Like, that's not going to go down well on socials, is it, James? Stella McCartney working with Arsenal? Or is it? Am I wrong?
Probably not, no.
Surely it's for the new influx of female football.
I was going to say, that's what I'd imagine it would be, yeah.
Styled on a man. Styled on a man. They've chosen a picture of a man here, but anyway.
You don't know how he identifies, you bigot.
Moving on from that point, James, what's next?
One of the points that we mentioned is in the white paper is this idea of like these people in the middle, like being conflicted about luxury and wanting to have some sort of like factor that can offset their participation. And often, as you said, Brett, like that can be like ethical or purpose based, so they don't feel like they're propagating like an elitist industry. We've got a recent example of luxury brands trying to demonstrate a social conscience as 15 fashion labels, including Jacquemus and Cactus Plant Flea Market, have dropped a t-shirt supporting Maui on My Mind, which is basically like a disaster relief fund for the people suffering from the wildfires in Maui in Hawaii.
It's not a new thing, like fundraiser t-shirt campaigns are not a new thing. I think it works, particularly for a certain type of audience. Again, an audience who's thinking, how am I going to spend my money in the future? I need to think about fashion in a more considered way. You know what? I'm going to spend where I've got an offset point. I can justify this t-shirt. It's a cool t-shirt. And I can tell my friends it's a fundraiser t-shirt. I'm going to feel good about it. I shouldn't really be buying new stuff and feeding the machine of like new production, but I can when it's something like that. So that's where we're at. I think we're in a sort of like a bit of a guilt trap, and we're looking to kind of spend and find those points that help us like justify. We're going to continue to see them because the audience of those brands are thinking about these factors. They're feeling pressurized to think about them. And when the brand comes forward and says, you don't need to worry about it because we worried about it for you, boom, money comes in.
Matt, do you think it's performative or are you down with it?
When I saw it in the article, I was like, yeah, fine. The bit that then suddenly jarred with me is when you see the reverse.
And it's I hadn't seen that.
Yeah. All of those brands are on it. It's like...
It's awful. So it's got like a step and repeat of loads of different brands on the back.
It looks like a fucking nice Formula One kit.
It looks like a PowerPoint slide where you go, and this is our client list.
But that to me feels like, hey, we're supporting charity. Mm. You know, and I feel like if you're going to support the charity, you don't necessarily need to print all your brand logos all over the back of the t-shirt to drive that point. Do you know what I mean? I 100% agree with Brett. Is that from a consumer point of view is an easier way for me to engage with those brands if I'm in the middle and I have reservations, ethical, moral reservations. So I'm totally down with that. Where did they make it though? Where did they get the t-shirts printed? Are they ethical like all the way through?
Fruit of the loom.
Yeah, Gildan, Fruit of the Loom. I'm sure they've thought that through because
you have to, right?
It's just the branding bit just feels a bit crass for me on the back.
To try to be charitable, which I am so often, is there any chance that, because this was set up by like a Hawaii-based creative studio, is there any chance that the creative studio would be the ones insisting that the brands go on the back because there's a greater chance of then it being spread, of people taking, like noticing that t-shirt with like the Brain Dead logo or whatever on it and thinking, oh, what's that? Then looking it up and seeing, and then it could potentially raise more funds. I might be naive.
I don't think it's just about funds. I think it's about awareness as well.
Sure, awareness.
So, and I think you're completely right. It's like if that creative studio, whoever they are, said we're doing a fundraiser t-shirt and they put it out there, they wouldn't get as much traction, as much coverage, as much news. We wouldn't be talking about it right now. There are other campaigns out there, right, raising money for the same issue. We're talking about this one because it has strategically applied hype fashion brands to get attention amongst a certain audience, a young audience.
But you can still do that, you know, almost like contractually, each one of those brands dedicate
some
element of budget
or something like that. It's just bad.
Well, not even branding it. Use their platform, use their community, use their channels to push it without necessarily using their sort of logo as a collective of logos. So, you know, your average Johnny in the street sees the t-shirt, may not have seen the campaign. I'm a little bit on the fence about the whole thing.
So I think the consensus here is like, nice idea, bad delivery. Jay.
Yeah, you want one more?
Go on, let's have one more. Okay. One more for the road.
It's good that you said that because we didn't want this to just be fashion. So we've got a booze one in here, but I'd say luxury booze is potentially a harder sell for like next gen audiences than fashion for all of the reasons that we've mentioned. Because with fashion, you get that kind of immediate reward of having people see it. Whereas like, unless you're popping bottles at the club or whatever, like you could have an expensive single malt on your shelf for months without anyone seeing it. So it's a different kind of pleasure.
Did you see the Bottle Wars post last week though?
What's that?
Bottle Wars. Was it Baltimore? Did you see it? I think it was Baltimore versus, I think it might have been Atlanta, and like two crews in a club, and it was all over social, were basically buying the most expensive booze they can and just pouring it out.
Nice.
And it was almost like a rap battle between two like crews of young groups of people who'd gone out on the piss in wherever this club was. And we're just pouring out like $1,000, $5,000 bottles of, you name it, spirits, champagne,
now
or the rest of it.
That's a flex. That's a flex.
That is luxury.
That's luxury for you.
But it does go to show that like those luxury booze brands have a part to play in this whole conversation, right? Is, you know, what started out as being kind of mentioned in a few songs with like Courvoisier and Hennessy and stuff like that, then started to be, you know, P. Diddy and Ciroc, as he was then, whatever his name is now, don't know. Then Ace of Spades, you know, the Armand de Brignac champagne. That kind of whole crowd started to get into owning and flexing with their booze brands. You know, the story about Jay-Z buying Armand de Brignac is brilliant. It's because, like, what's the gold champagne? I can't remember the brand at the moment. They refused to kind of let him feature it in something or something like that. So he went, fuck you, I'm going to go and buy my own then. And he bought like a 200-year-old champagne vineyard. It's like, that is a flex. I'm going to go and buy one. I fucking love that. But yeah, that check out the Bottle Wars post that was all over social a few days ago.
We've got a story, and that was kind of why I bought this one, because it's about Courvoisier, and I feel like cognac in particular is an interesting example, because it was kind of...
Is all like...
Well, exactly. It should be a kind of... It's a French old lady's drinks cabinet drink.
It's embraced it at some point, and it's never looked back.
Exactly. And when we're looking at the influence of the strata again, then I feel like cognac in particular is an interesting example of how it exists like, at both poles, I suppose. But the actual story that we've got, because it's happening this week, so we wanted it to be kind of current. Courvoisier have partnered with the artist Yinka Ilori to open a pop-up bar designed by the artist in Selfridges, which apparently no one should give a fuck about, launching a collaborative bottle.
To Matt's point earlier on about like luxury being creative, I went to a Courvoisier event probably about like 12 years ago or like 10 years ago maybe, and it was so fucking wicked. It was like you went through time where you're going through like different times where you would get a little meal, so a tiny little meal, and you were going through like 18th century London, and then you went through a room and it was like the 1950s, and every room was designed beautifully before you ended up in like this beautiful restaurant, and you enjoyed Courvoisier along the way. And I've loved Courvoisier since then. Like, I've just got an affinity with the brand. So when I saw this, I'm like, yeah, I mean, it looks wicked. Like, anything that Courvoisier do, I always lean in, because I feel there is some really good creativity there.
In my opinion, you know, it's an Instagram play. It's going to be...
Oh, it looks very Instagrammable.
Yeah, 100%. Look, the artist is an amazing artist, has a very particular look and feel, and it's going to be about like how do we cut through on socials,
100%.
And that alignment is like the key to the strategy, I would say, because actually when you look at what brands in that space have been doing in more recent times, they would have been more directly collaborating with like basketball or like traditional American sports, or you know, more overtly like coordinating with like rap culture or something like that. And this is like a slightly different move. I'm not sure if culturally this is landing in exactly the right space. The top to the bottom piece, Yinka Ilori, I think sits quite strongly in the middle with like, you know, a gallery going subset.
It's kind
of
this kind of intelligentsia almost. Yeah.
I'm not to say that like there's not regular people who can't appreciate that artist and the artist's work, but for the most part, the audience that's engaged with that person aren't going to be your flexing mob. Yeah. They're not going to be your super elite wealth group either.
This is the sort of thing that I would take my missus to make her happy. I think this is...
Yeah, to be fair, this is the sort of thing I'd take your missus to as well.
I think they've looked at like what Jacquemus did with that whole sort of swimming pool pop-up, and what Bottega Veneta have done with that maximalist sort of retail pop-up, and went, we'll have some of that. It's going to get us on various sort of publishing on the web. It's going to get us in everybody's Instagram feed that goes there, and it's going to pop.
Well, I don't buy what Martin says, because I do like Selfridges. I think that they've always got some sort of creative event like going on throughout the year. I think that the person that goes to this, I really agree with you, Brett. It's so Instagrammable. Every restaurant does this now. Everywhere you go has got that like Instagrammable background. But I agree. I don't think it's a high net worth individual that's going to be going to this. I don't think it's necessarily people that are entwined in hip-hop culture that are going to be going to this.
Is that the issue, that compared to some of the other examples that we've seen, is the lack of obvious crossover between audiences? Like, I'm not sure that kind of his fans will necessarily be cognac drinkers, and I'm not sure that Courvoisier fans will give a shit about this art exhibition.
That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly.
But booze is really difficult, I find, because the product doesn't change. Or, you know, pretty much doesn't change. So you need lots of energy moments, as we've talked about. I think go back to the days of like Absolut Vodka, and their energy moment was initially the ads. New ad comes out, you know, with the silhouette of the bottle on. Then they start to actually print on the bottles and things like that. I think booze needs better, more interesting, more higher turnover marketing, but it costs an awful lot of money as well. I also have like a little bit of a personal issue sometimes when booze gets involved with art, because especially at the more expensive end, it just becomes this sort of elitist kind of signal of you don't understand art.
I thought with this, it's a bit of kind of, it's cultural discernment now sort of thing. Yeah.
What else are they doing as part of that campaign to support artists maybe, or to support self-expression? Is there a bit that I haven't seen yet that goes along with paying that artist for his work and getting an Instagrammable energy moment?
James, when does this podcast go out? Do you know?
Yeah, well, apparently it goes out. Is this inside baseball? It goes out next week when the white paper's out.
Okay, so if you want to find more out about our event, I'm being real with you. It hasn't happened yet, but it has if you're listening to this. Go and check out our Instagram. There'll be a couple of videos from the event that we had. Download the white paper. It's called The Next Agenda. Where can they find that? Do you know? Oh, I'll put him on the spot.
You've got to prep me for that.
It'll be on our website. You'll be able to get a download from there. But yeah, listen, it's been interesting. Thanks very much, Brett. Thank you very much, Matt. James?
Zachagency.com/whitepaper, one word, which we probably need to update now to The Next Agenda.
Smooth.
So it might be that, or it might be The Next Agenda. Just go to the website.
Or onto socials.
Yeah, or onto socials, or your inbox.
All right, guys, thanks very much. Cheers.
Nice one.